security cannot come through technology alone. We don't build bank safes and then leave them in the bank robber's sitting room, even really good bank safes. We rely on the rule of law to backstop technological security. You know, Julian Assange wrote this paper called Rubber Hose Cryptanalysis years and years ago, before he was the man in the Ecuadorian embassy, about the fact that, like, one of the great weaknesses of cryptography is that even really good passphrases can be compelled from people if you can sit them in a chair, handcuff them to it, and hit them with a rubber hose until they tell you what it is, right? And so the rule of law is absolutely necessary if we're going to defend ourselves against surveillance, whether or not we care about private surveillance or state surveillance. And the rule of law is not on our side here.
Welcome to Upvote, a tech and politics podcast from Wired, Ars Technica UK. My name is Roland Manthorpe, and the voice you just heard, that belongs to Cory Doctorow, the science fiction writer, who is here today in our very hot and sweaty studio / store cupboard. It's great to have him here because he's not only one of the world's smartest thinkers about this intersection between tech and politics, but he's also a doer, a long-time political activist, who's currently working on a really interesting project with Electronic Freedom Foundation to sue the US government to try and get it to remove DRM, which is the software that stops you using computers for uses that aren't approved by the manufacturer. So that's the reason that you can't turn a Kindle book into a PDF. That's DRM. I'm sure we'll touch on that later. But first, Cory, I have to ask about President Donald Trump. Now, I think 4 or 5 months into what is really an increasingly mad presidency. I mean, you're based in the US at the moment, although you're Canadian. When you look at this, what do you see?
So I think that Trump's strength and weakness are both playing out, and it's parallel to the strengths and weaknesses of all networked insurgencies. It's what... I'm going to say her name wrong, but Zeynep Tufekci writes about in her new book, Tear Gas and Twitter. It's that when you attain power by building a big tent, by using networks to gather people who have different views, by never crisply identifying why you're there and just saying, look, let's all get together and see whether we can agree on something to do, even if we can't agree on why we're doing it, you can build these really big movements really fast. And that's Trumpism, but it's also, you know, Occupy and Black Lives Matter, but, you know, and also ISIS, right? I mean, lots of different organizations have been able to build themselves out this way. Their weakness is that they have a hard time maneuvering smoothly in concert. If the thing that they're trying to do decomposes readily into a bunch of individual tasks, like getting around the perimeter of a kettle and massing again on the other side, big distributed decentralized groups are amazing at it. If what you're trying to do is get everybody to work in concert to make a thing happen, it's really hard. And so the Trump administration has been in a shambles. I don't think Trump knows any of this stuff. I think that, like, there are a billion potential strongman clowns out there all trying various strategies all the time, just like your skin is crawling with a billion variations on, you know, Staphylococcus bacteria. And then one of them will just find a hospitable zone, right? A break in the skin, and it'll go in and colonize. And if the immune system doesn't take it out, which is what we see happening to Trump right now, then it thrives and sometimes kills its host, which I think Trump still has pretty good odds of doing.
So then... what we're talking about is, let's say, a network that has taken over the host, or a bacteria that's taken over the host, I mean.
Yeah.
What does that mean for government in the US that's happened?
Well, so the thing is that it's very hard to actually be a government unless you can maneuver hierarchy and do the political work of convincing people, many of whom could get better jobs in the private sector, to go along with your agenda. I mean, Yes Minister is something of a documentary here. You know, after Suharto Revolution, they tried to run the Indonesia without the civil service. It turns out that running, like, one of the world's most populous nations without any of the people who know where the bin bags are kept and where the light switches are and where the fuses are is really hard, right? You spend a lot of time looking for bin bags and trying to change the fuses. And so they ended up bringing the civil service back. And, you know, this is what Trump is facing, is that He's like running across the river on the backs of the crocodiles and hoping that none of them eats him, and that he can stay ahead of them and basically get in and get out with as many billions for him and his friends as possible before the whole thing collapses behind him. And in that sense, it's a very businesslike way of running a country. You know, people often point out that a government is not a business and a CEO is not a president. But, you know, there is a kind of business that the kind of President Trump is, which is hedge fund corporate raiders. You know, you take over a company, you load it up with debt, you take all that money out of the business, and then you run away just before it falls over. Now, there was a period in the 80s where there was all this mergers and acquisitions and private equity money in publishing, and one of the big publishers was taken over in a hostile takeover, and then their new turnaround CEO saved a whole ton of money for the investors through the simple expedient of canceling all the books in their production pipeline. And then her name was Althea Disney. It was HarperCollins. And then she bailed with a huge bonus, having put the company on this amazing financial footing because it had like no outgoings. And then the next year, it nearly collapsed because, hey, they didn't have any books in the pipeline. This is Trumpism. Trumpism is that you take all of the things that makes America, if not great, at least viable, and you sell them off, gut them, or load them up with debt, and then you walk away whistling with your hands in your pockets before everything collapses behind you. I mean, it's the same wheeze that gave us the financial crisis, right? Loan out a bunch of money, securitize the debt, trouser the profits, buy an island, and then, as the world crumbles behind you, hold your hands up and say, gosh, who'd have thought that that could have happened? No one could have predicted it.
What is the way out of this? That's what I find hard to imagine. How do we get out of this this kind of condition that we've got ourselves into?
Well, here's where an engineering mindset becomes an interesting approach to politics. So in engineering, there are often problems that can't be fully known. There's terrain that can't be mapped before you try and map it. And the way you discover your route across the terrain is traversing it. And in those environments, if you're writing software, for example, you employ something called a hill climbing algorithm. So imagine an ant on a hill, in a hilly landscape, and it wants to find a peak. The ant checks to see which of its legs is on higher ground. And if more than one is on higher ground, it checks to see which one has the steepest gradient. And it moves one step in that direction and does it again. Now, if you can imagine a hilly landscape, you can imagine that the ant might reach a local maximum, a peak that isn't the highest peak. It'll always reach a peak. And sometimes the thing we do in hill climbing is we shake things up and drop the algorithm back into a trough and see if it can find another hill to climb. But in politics, the way that I play this out is I look around at the world and check to see if there's a single thing I can do that will make the world a better place, make the world more hospitable for the kind of future I want to live in, and less hospitable for the kind of looter, rentier, you know, dumpster fire, Cheeto Hitler future that Trump is ushering in. And I take that one step to see if from that step I can find something new. Because, you know, there isn't a clear path from A to Z. And if there were, it wouldn't remain clear because the first casualty of any battle is the plan of attack. As soon as the forces of anti-Trumpism take a step, the forces of pro-Trumpism deploy a countermeasure. And so even if we know how to get from here to there now, that path won't be clear as soon as we start down it. And so our strength is our nimbleness and our improvisatory skill and our ability to use networks to allow people on the edges to make decisions without stepping on each other's feet, because the network helps us find out where someone's just made a choice and make sure that we don't inadvertently undo the work they've done without having to have a hierarchy where someone looks down at the whole thing and decides who's going to go where.
You refer to Trumpism. Is it an ideology? And I guess I'm asking you, or wondering, in what sense is Trump a symptom of a wider systemic issue?
Mm.
Or if actually he's a bit of a one-off and after this we'll revert to some kind of normalcy?
Well, you know, when I left the UK after the Tory landslide, thinking there's just no way I can do this for another 5 years, and moved to the US, I had loads of Hungarian and Polish friends.
This was in 2015, I think.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, and Turkish friends.
Yeah, the surprise victory rather than a landslide.
Well, surprise victory then.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I had Turkish friends and Polish friends and Hungarian friends who said, like, you aren't gonna find a spot that's better than this one, right? I mean, it's everything is the same everywhere. We are in the grips of this big social phenomenon that is producing, you know, populist strongmen. And I have a theory about it, which is that the Overton window does not allow us to say the system has been rigged by finance, and that finance is not producing good outcomes. Finance is just making rich people richer. And anyone who's willing to say that, anyone who's willing to say the system is rigged, gets the benefit of the doubt about everything else they say. Because if you're the only mainstream political voice saying the system is rigged, and if everyone secretly knows the system is rigged, and everyone knows that all of those politicians who've been saying the system's not rigged, the system is fair, finance produces Pareto optimal outcomes, you know, that kind of neoclassical lots of equations, the property bubble will never burst, it will just expand forever, then the fact that someone's saying a thing you know to be true and that is really salient to your life makes you kind of give them the benefit of the doubt about everything else. I think that's how the Muslim Brotherhood got elected after the Egyptian Revolution. You know, for decades, they've been the only political voice willing to say, Hosni Mubarak is not a competent leader. Hosni Mubarak gets guns and treasure from the West because he has a politically expedient view on Israel. Which, you know, in mainstream Egyptian politics was like, you are a crazy conspiracy theorist, even though it's, you know, radioactively obvious and visible from orbit. And after the Mubarak regime falls, these people who are the only people who said a thing everybody knows is true suddenly become credible, even though their overall governing philosophy is, you know, an incoherent mass of like ancient superstition and rubbish. But this on this one score, they were true. So you have Nigel Farage, who doesn't get a French pronunciation so long as he wants us out of the EU, who says the system is rigged, everything is rubbish, blah, blah, blah. And everyone knows it's true, right? The fact that he rigged the system, he wants to rig it more, he will benefit from that rigging, does not actually matter more than the fact that he's the only one willing to say the one true thing that no one else is willing to say. Same thing happens with Trump. And so, you know, that philosophy, right? And I call it, you know, in my Canadian way, I named it after Leonard Cohen. I call it the everybody knows phenomenon, is really, I think, the root of Trumpism. We call it Trumpism because America is the 800-pound elephant, but we could call it, you know, Sisiism, and we could call it Erdoganism, but you know, these days we can call it Mayism, but Trumpism is probably how we'll remember it. In the same way that, you know, maybe Hitler didn't burn down the Reichstag, but he's the one who we think of when we think of the Reichstag in flames. And there's Godwin's Law, 7 minutes.
Nice.
Yeah.
So then I guess that leads to the question, what is the systemic problem? Where is this all coming from? And I guess the most common explanation out there would be that in some way this all relates to the Great Recession. This is a product of the 2008 financial crisis and what's come from there.
So I think that the crisis is an effect, not a cause. I think that the financialization of everything, the shift, you know, that you can really date to Thatcher and Reagan and Pinochet and Brian Mulroney in Canada, from markets as a place that you go to once a fortnight to a moral ideology that tells you who is deserving and who isn't. This kind of circular reasoning of meritocracy, which, you know, I hasten to remind you was a satirical term when it was coined by the same fine fellow who gave us the Open University, that this idea that, like, the best people are rewarded by the market, and we can tell because we're the best people we know and the market has rewarded us, that moral philosophy, after decades, did not produce shared prosperity, did not produce productivity gains, right? You know, we talk a lot about robots taking everybody's jobs. Robots aren't taking everybody's jobs. Why would anyone pay to build robots when labor is so cheap after the systematic dismantling of all labor, health and safety, and environmental rules for a decade and a half? And so, you know, I think Thomas Piketty really put his finger on this, that the orgy of capital destruction that was the two world wars and the interwar years produced a much more equal society in which policy outcomes were much more evidence-led because, you know, the special pleading of a small aristocracy just couldn't be backed with the kind of financial clout that would have turned into policy outcomes. But because over time capital accumulates, the rich got richer, and then when they got rich enough, they were able to create governmental structures that were grounded in the idea that, quote, there is no alternative, there is no such thing as society, shared destiny is a myth. You know, on the one hand, everyone should, we're all in this together, and on the other hand, there is no such thing as society. And, you know, if that's not having your cake and eating it too, I don't know what is.
Because Piketty is a big fan of, I guess, social democracy. In a way, he's looking to try and recreate those conditions that existed after the war years.
Right.
And in one sense, he's a very hopeful writer because he says that can be done. In another sense, he's quite pessimistic because he seems to imply that you need some terrible crisis to convince people that they need to act together in this way.
Yeah, he thinks that you can convince aristocrats that they'll get guillotines, right? And you know, there is, you know, to bring this back to technology, there is an intrinsic instability to wealth inequality because everybody has dumb ideas. But when a small number of people are in charge and no one can check their authority, their dumb ideas take on a much greater role. So, you know, in Saudi, it's that like 52% of the population should be excluded from civic life. And, you know, someday some prince of the House of Saud is going to die of cancer that would have been cured by a woman who wasn't allowed to drive without her husband in the car. And that is like a bad outcome that they create through their own dumb ideas. And here we have the dumb idea that, you know, we can weaponize shelter and turn our cities into, you know, great heaving clusters of safe deposit boxes in the sky for offshore criminal millionaires instead of places where people can live. And in America, you have climate denial and the idea that the seas will boil, but it won't matter because we can just seek out the high ground and, you know, breed our children by Harrier jet. And, you know, this instability eventually reaches a point where, at least in a rather an irrational society, the kind of the social democratic model, the elites say, all right, then, it is cheaper for us to build hospitals and schools than it is for us to pay guards to keep people from building guillotines. And so we'll just build some hospitals and schools. You know, Sweden has massive income inequality, but not massive wealth inequality, right? They just tax it. They tax it all back, right? And so that rationalist approach is what Piketty is appealing to. But it turns out that there's another way to stabilize societies apart from building hospitals and schools, and that's guard labor. And guard labor gets cheaper when you have big surveillance networks. You know, the Stasi were employing like one snitch for every 60 people in the GDR because it was an artisanal leather apron shortage kind of surveillance where you had individuals filling jars with the, you know, stolen knickers of potential political suspects so that they could be given to sniffer dogs if they ever went on the run. Whereas today, you know, the NSA is able to spy on like 10,000 people per NSA agent. That two and a half order of magnitude lift in productivity, that comes out of automation, right? That is a place where robots have replaced spooks, but instead of hiring less spooks, we've just given the spooks bigger jobs to do because it turns out that there's like no end to how much data you can gather if you don't care whether you catch guilty people and just if you can inspire fear in people. And so now we have, you know, the Investigatory Powers Act where they're saying, oh, we're just going to ban working crypto in Britain. And, you know, you ban working crypto and you give everyone a device that does everything for them and that mediates all their interactions. And you can do some pretty thoroughgoing surveillance. And that gives you a path to kind of separating the sheep from the goats, to figuring out who you should watch and who you can leave off to one side. We're actually seeing it play out in other countries. In Ethiopia, it's really like the world's first turnkey surveillance state. It's a, you know, basket case, hugely unequal, near failed state where nevertheless the same ruling elite have held power for a long time. And the way they've done it is they buy surveillance tools from European companies. Those surveillance tools are probably backdoored by European surveillance apparatus. And they just use it to figure out who to arrest and torture. And so they're able to stay stable much longer. So at EFF, we have a client, he's known in the court records as Mr. Kadani. He was a dissident Ethiopian journalist who fled Ethiopia and was living as a permanent resident in DC. When the Ethiopian government bought from an Italian company a hacking tool that they used to break into his Skype in America to mine his social graph, and then they rounded up all of his confederates in Ethiopia and imprisoned them and tortured them. Right. So that's kind of where technology and politics meet here. There's always been inequality, but inequality has always been checked by the instability of letting rich weirdos run wild with their dumb ideas, right? And now rich weirdos can run wild with their dumb ideas a lot longer, because the point at which we can effectively build guillotines, or credibly threaten to build guillotines, has been moved far along by surveillance technology. And so the rich weirdos get to do a lot more damage before they either their inner rational voice or the instability wrought by failing to heed it puts an end to the climate change madness, the institutionalized misogyny, the rampant financialization.
And I guess this brings us to your book.
Sure.
Which you're in town talking about. It's called Walk Away. It's a fascinating read. And I was really struck by one line in it where you say that the people in it are faced with a choice between property and surveillance. In order to escape surveillance, they have to essentially give up the idea of property. This is working out of a potential future in which people are forced by rising inequality, technological surveillance, to escape from the system into some kind of, what would you call it? Is it a proto-communism?
I sometimes call it the Zipcar version of fully automated luxury communism, where, you know, we have quite amazing things, and kind of at the moment you need them, they're there, but they kind of circulate in a never-ending, highly automated cloud to whoever needs them next. You know, I think that, like, property is already grossly unstable because we've created a kind of neo-feudalism through things like Article 6 of the EUCD, which bans breaking DRM even for a lawful purpose. And so you have cars where, even though you own the car, you may not even owe any money to the bank on it, the manufacturer can use DRM on the car's engine to decide which mechanic you're allowed to take it to. And so any mechanic who tries to diagnose your engine without the official tool has to break the DRM and thus commit a potential felony. And so you can only go to mechanics that the vendor has blessed, the original manufacturer has blessed. HP does this with the consumables on their printers. They pushed a fake security update last year to millions of OfficeJet and OfficeJet Pro owners that it looked like something that would patch your printer against, you know, vulnerabilities. What it really did was make your printer able to distinguish remanufactured cartridges from original equipment manufacturer cartridges, so that it wouldn't let you use the ink of your choosing. Well, you know, Blackwell, he called property that over those things of the universe over which man enjoys the sole and despotic dominion to the exclusion of all others. If the manufacturer's cold hand lays on your physical goods long after you've bought them, ready to kind of smack you for failing to arrange your affairs to the benefit of their shareholders, then you don't own it, right? We have a name for a system where only a small elite get to own property and everybody else has to rent it from them and use it on the terms that they set. It's called feudalism. And so we are already heading into a post-property world. So the question that Walkaway asks is, could we have a post-property world that wasn't one of rentierism and feudalism? Could we have something like a Zipcar, which is obviously more efficient, right? Very few of us buy a car because we're like, this is a gorgeous machine that I will treasure every time I ride in it, right? Most of us buy a car because we need to get from A to B. Well, if you can have a way to get from A to B without having to have a garage, without having to pay a mechanic, without even having to buy petrol, that is a better car in every way, except to the extent that that car is actually owned by a distant rentier who, to a fine extent, tells you what you can and can't do and can revoke your access to the car on their whim. And then it's actually a kind of nightmare scenario. You know, as Spinal Tap says, there's such a fine line between clever and stupid. And so, you know, could we have a post-property world where, rather than trying to, like, allocate property with markets, but only to a small elite, we just say, we can allocate property with networks. I mean, that's how, like, it works internally, right? You know, Peter Thiel's companies do not operate as little internal marketplaces in which people do bids and puts to figure out what job they're going to do this week, right? They're like command economies where, you know, the Joseph Stalin of Thiel Industries, who's Peter Thiel, tells everyone what they're going to do or sends them to the gulag.
Well, you've had Hitler
and Stalin.
Yes, very impressive.
Should we work in a Mussolini and we'll see if we can get the triumvirate?
Oh, I think we just did. I look forward to that.
Yeah.
When I talk to activists about this, I think there's often a confusion whether they should be more worried about the state or more worried about big companies. Who do you fear most in this, or is it the uneasy alliance of the two?
I'm going to invoke that gif now of the little girl saying, why can't we have both? So security cannot come through technology alone, right? We don't build bank safes and then leave them in the bank robber's sitting room, even really good bank safes. We rely on the rule of law to backstop technological security. You know, Julian Assange wrote this paper called Rubber Hose Cryptanalysis years and years ago, before he was the man in the Ecuadorian embassy, about the fact that, like, one of the great weaknesses of cryptography is that even really good passphrases can be compelled from people if you can sit them in a chair, handcuff them to it, and hit them with a rubber hose until they tell you what it is, right? And so the rule of law is absolutely necessary if we're going to defend ourselves against surveillance, whether or not we care about private surveillance or state surveillance. And the rule of law is not on our side here. You know, where you have states that have conceived of this idea that the way that they will preserve their order is through total, continuous, long-term and archived surveillance. You know, this idea that we just save everything and then we travel back in time. We catch you, you know, reading a dodgy book on the tube, as has happened when people have been stopped by the Met on the tube. And we decide, well, I don't like the look of your literary choices. Let's go back in your history and find out all the places you've been, the things you've done, and everyone you've talked to. Then those states are not going to tell firms that they're not allowed to gather and retain data. Rather, they're going to create retention mandates for firms where they'll order them to gather data and retain it, which is, you know, a feature of the IP bill that passed last year. Now, realistically speaking, any data that you gather and any data that you retain will eventually leak. You know, this is the lesson of GCHQ and NSA. It's the lesson of Ashley Madison. It's the lesson of innumerable other leaks that are coming. You know, just go to Have I Been Pwned and look at their billion leaked passwords and email addresses. And you'll see that the leaks are at the beginning, not the end. We're in the tremor, not the quake. And so a state that was making good policy, a state that didn't want all the external costs of these breaches to be borne by its taxpayers, would order companies to minimize their retention. And they could either do that directly through these orders, or they could do it indirectly by doing things like saying, we will hold you liable for all downstream harm to users arising from breaches. Practically speaking, there's almost no liability for this. You know, in the U.S., you have firms that breach hundreds of millions of credit card numbers and are charged literally 30 cents each in class action settlements, along with a 6-month voucher for credit monitoring service. Now, meanwhile, you know, 2 years ago, there's a rash of stories in the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal, or the Wall Street Journal and the Times of London, Financial Times, one or the other, about people having their houses stolen by identity thieves. So, you know, you would have a second property that you'd rent out, or you go away on holiday, and an identity thief would gather all the data from all of these breaches, merge it, use it to get a duplicate deed, go to, in one case, it was Foxton's, and sell your multi-million pound house out from under you for cash, and then bugger off and never be heard from again. And you come home from your holiday, someone else lives there. Right. So, you know, in a realistic world, you might see Parliament passing a law or a Secretary of State making secondary legislation that said, if you breach data, you are liable for 1% of the total value of the property holdings of everyone whose data you just breached, because that's about the rate we expect people to lose their houses from your breach over the long term. Well, no firm would retain any data if the potential liability for breaching that data was 1% of all of the property holdings of the users. Right. So the states have lots of levers to change retention. They use none of them. And the reason they use none of them is because they want all that data retained so that they have a way to spy on us on the cheap. GCHQ, the reason it's so good at its job is because everybody else does their job for it. You do it by carrying the phone that tracks your steps. Your mobile carrier does it by tracking the phone. Google does it by tracking the data that your mobile carrier sends to it. And so GCHQ just sits in the middle. They and you know, sucks it up like a big fat spider right in the middle of a web. So if you care about private surveillance and you want the state to curb it, then you need to care about state surveillance. And if you care about state surveillance and you want firms to stand fast against states who plunder their troves for data, then you need states to have a good rule of law. You know, when we try to build systems that are impregnable on their own without reference to the rule of law, we do things like we build King Tut's tomb, rather, right? Where we say, oh, we'll build a thing that will work even when all of the temporal authorities are gone. It will still keep all of our adversaries out. Well, all the stuff from King Tut's tomb is in a museum now. Because when your adversary has unlimited time and unlimited resources and no one around to tell them to cut it out, they always get through your defenses. So we need the rule of law too. And so markets, technology, they won't do the job on their own. We need good political systems too. And if I could, I'll plug an organization I helped found here in the UK, the Open Rights Group, which is a not-for-profit pressure group that works on these issues alongside groups like Privacy International, Amnesty, Liberty, and so on.
I was really struck by this dynamic, actually, during that debate over whether Apple should let the FBI have a backdoor into the iPhone.
Mm-hmm.
Because we were asked to either line up behind the FBI in the name of national security or behind Apple in the name of privacy. But Apple is not necessarily, although they do, I think, better work than some companies, not necessarily a friend here. And well, I suppose in a way, because what's the third option? Where does civil society or that extra thing come in here?
You know, this is something where Martha Lane Fox's new charity is doing some good work. This idea, this dot everyone project of building a civic internet that is neither the domain of government nor the domain of firms. You know, Apple has in fact seized on the idea of privacy as a sales tool, as a market differentiator, and for this we should be grateful.
Privacy for rich people.
Well, there's lots of people who aren't rich who have iPhones, right? But they generally end up getting followed around by their phone carriers, if not by Apple. But Apple has done some really good work on the privacy front. But they didn't do it because of an ideological commitment. Firms don't have ideological commitments because, despite the legal fiction, firms aren't people, right? Firms are, at best, these kind of colony organisms that are kind of immortal and transhuman. And their relationship to people is that people are like their gut flora. But they're not people, and they don't have views. They have incentives, and Apple's incentive is to maximize its shareholder returns. And so where Apple has found it viable in service of its shareholders to do that, they have. But where they haven't found it viable, they haven't, right? So they don't design iPhones that have sideband radios that are resistant to IMSI catchers, because that would also make them resistant to mobile carriers who wanted to bill the phones, right? Now, if their commitment was to privacy, that would be a thing that would be very important, right? Because, you know, if you don't want people to be tracked for carrying their iPhones, you need to harden the sideband, right? Otherwise, people just get tracked all the time. And Apple doesn't want to do that. Apple has lobbied extensively in the US and Canada to continue for it to be illegal for third parties to service and maintain its devices. They threatened security researchers who pointed out defects in their products. You know, all of those are things that weaken privacy, but are good for Apple's bottom line. And this is not unique to Apple, right? Google has its own complex, crappy story, and Amazon has its own complex, crappy story. I think the answer is you can't count on a company to give you your privacy. You need for a company to have a market incentive to make you more private, and for that market incentive to come in part from regulation and in part from a normative discussion like this one we're having now, where people go, oh, you breached my privacy. That wasn't like an inevitable consequence of unforeseeable circumstances. That was your total depraved indifference to my long-term health and stability in the service of lining your investors' pockets. Screw you. I'm coming to your house with a pitchfork and a torch, right? Like all of those things together, along with the technology that lets us enact them, that's what helps us move forward, but not like picking a company and hoping, crossing your fingers and hoping that they never screw you over or make mistakes.
You're working actively in one area in all this.
Mm-hmm.
I know you talk about the way that, is it your namesake, E.L. Doctorow, talks about writing a novel, and you only see how, it's like driving a car at night, yeah. And you only see the distance ahead of you and you keep on going. Your next step involves, along with your collaborators, suing the US government. Maybe you could explain
Sure. Why
you're doing that and why you think that's important.
Although let me say, E.L. Doctorow and I are not related.
That's important to note.
It's a Belarusian patronymic, Doktorovich. It was created by a czar who wanted to collect tax from Jews, and they just went around and randomly gave people surnames. Lots of people called Doktorovich were not all related, except to the extent that most Ashkenazis are like fourth cousins. But the lawsuit. So laws around the world, EUCD Article 6 in Europe, DMC 1201 in America, 92A in New Zealand, Bill C-11 in Canada, they make it against the law to break DRM, to bypass DRM, even for a lawful purpose. And so this has posed an enormous temptation to companies, because companies have a mix of legal obligations or legal rights and commercial preferences. You know, I have the right to stop you from selling counterfeit ink cartridges. I don't have the right to stop you from selling non-counterfeit ink cartridges that work in my customers' printers, right? So long as you don't say this is an HP cartridge and trick people, then, you know, making third-party spares is like making third-party bread for a toaster, right? It's not my business as HP whose ink goes in my printer. It's my customer's business. And if they choose, without any deception, to buy your third-party cartridge, that's fine. But because breaking DRM is illegal, if you design the product so that using it in a way that the manufacturer doesn't like requires first breaking DRM, then every commercial preference becomes a legal right. So you have John Deere Tractor designing their tractors so that when you replace a part, you have to pay $150 and wait a day for a technician to come out and enter a long serial number into a console in the front of the tractor in order to activate that part to stop you from buying third-party spares. They also gather telemetry from the tractor as you drive it around your fields. They have the torque sensors that tell you about your soil density. They have the humidity sensors, and then they have a location sensor. But you don't get that data back from John Deere, even though you generated that data by driving your tractor around your field. John Deere uses it to play the futures market, to sell that data as market intelligence about future crop yields. And then they'll give you partial access to that data if you buy it with an app that comes with seed from Monsanto or Cargill. So, you know, this idea of converting a commercial preference to a legal right, it's a very tempting one. And incidentally, reporting a defect in a product that has DRM in it potentially gives rise to the same liability. Because if I tell you about the mistake that John Deere or Apple or GM or Google made when they designed their DRM, I tell you where you should start working if you want to bypass that DRM. And so firms have successfully used DRM law to both chill and actually prosecute security researchers who come forward with, you know, news about defects in their products, which what company wouldn't like as an added bonus, the right to decide who and how information about their dumb mistakes could be made public to their customers. Like, maybe we just don't want that declared until after our quarterly report is in and we've had our shareholder meeting. You know, maybe we'll bury that on a Friday afternoon. So, you know, in 2015, the U.S. Copyright Office held hearings on this. They hold them every 3 years. And they heard about people who found, you know, really grave defects in things like insulin pumps and implanted defibrillators.
This is the real nightmare, right?
Yeah. Yeah, well, but it's everything now, right? Like, what isn't a computer? And what thing that doesn't have a computer in it couldn't be made more profitable by adding some DRM and then telling your customers how they're allowed to use it? So, yeah, but defibrillators are scary, but so are cars. You know, a jet is a flying Solaris workstation in a fancy aluminium case, right? So the Copyright Office heard about all these defects, and the people who found them had not come forward. And they were, and so we launched this lawsuit against the U.S. government, where we represent two different clients that have two different theories about why this is unconstitutional. One is a guy named Matthew Green. He's a security researcher at Johns Hopkins. And he has a National Science Foundation grant and a publishing contract to do work on the security of a whole bunch of systems, voting machines, the black boxes used to do high-speed financial transaction processing, a bunch of other stuff. And all of that stuff has DRM. He potentially could give rise to criminal and civil liability for doing it. And he's asking the court to find that the only way that copyright can be squared with the free speech rights guaranteed under the Constitution, the First Amendment, is by allowing, keeping copyright contained or cabined off to creative works and not allowing it to expand into anything that happens to have some copyrighted element. You know, in the same way that, like, your shirt might have a copyrighted logo on it, but that doesn't mean that selling the shirt on as used invokes some kind of copyright right on the part of the illustrator who drew your shirt. And that's already case law. The Supreme Court already held that in a case called Golan. So we're asking the court to interpret Golan in the strength of in the light of the statute, in light of his fact pattern. And then Bunny Wang, who's this legendary hardware hacker, guy broke the Xbox. He wrote one of the afterwards for Little Brother. He's a really great guy. he makes a thing called AnyTV, and AnyTV injects bitmaps into HDCP signals without breaking the DRM. It's really cool. You remember the HDCP keys leaked? So he uses them to encrypt a bitmap and inject it into the bitstream in HDCP. And it's used by like pubs that have, you know, big screen sky and want to say half price chips for the next 30 minutes. You make a bitmap of that and inject it into the stream, and it shows up in the lower quadrant of the screen. So he wants to build a thing called NetVCR, which actually does break HDCP and lets you record programming that's been restricted with HDCP to make fair uses. And in a case called Eldred, the Supreme Court held that the other thing that makes fair use or copyright and the First Amendment compatible is fair use. It's the limitation on copyright that allows for criticism, commentary, transformation. And so in both cases, the Supreme said that a copyright law was not constitutional unless it confined itself to traditional artistic works and unless it contained these limitations, these fair use limitations. And so between these two clients, we think that we can comprehensively gut the Section 1201 of the DMCA and open the door to lots of people making all kinds of tools that allow them to exercise copyright enjoy the limitations to copyright in respect of the traditional contours of copyright, and also to make fair uses. And at that point, there's no point in making DRM, because like DRM doesn't work as a technology. It doesn't stop piracy. People break DRM really quickly. What DRM does is it gives you the right to sue companies that let your customers do non-piracy things, like swap third-party detergent into their automatic cat litter pan or third-party cartridges into their coffee machine.
And let's say you succeed.
Yeah.
A lot of your work is gazing into the future. So we can end on a hopeful note.
Sure.
How could we create a better world without having to go through some awful crisis first, a la the Second World War, which, as we mentioned earlier, is what Piketty thinks gave us the previous period of relative harmony?
Well, so I'm not a prognosticator, right? I'm someone who tries to reflect the current reality. But, you know, Piketty is really saying not that we have to have an orgy of capital destruction, but that the power conferred by capital distorts policy outcomes. And one of the best ways to check that power is to reduce it, is to just take some of the money away from the super rich. And, you know, he proposes this tax, but, you know, the last time we did it by like blowing up Europe for 15 years across two big wars, right? So in light of that, the question is, how do you reduce the amount of power exercised by the super rich, or how do you check it with other forms of power? And I think that we actually are living a fairly interesting version of that. It's, you know, right now you have these insurgent networks of that have been kind of colonized by oligarchs, although they don't necessarily control them. I mean, Farage, you know, for all that he managed to pull off Brexit, he's definitely out in the woods now, and his MPs are literally punching each other's lights out in the halls of the Brussels Parliament. So, you know, it's not like the jury is in on whether this will only benefit the Farages and the Trumps and the Erdogans and not the Occupies and the Bernie Sanderses and the Momentums, you know. And so all of those have the power to put in check, or at least the credible power, given the right circumstances, the right tools, the right moves. They have at least a credible case at putting in check the enormous concentrations of power that the concentrations of wealth have delivered. And if they can, then we can deliver policy outcomes that once again improve the outcome, the overall outlook, where we get more broadly shared prosperity instead of this kind of looterism that is the current plan, you know, looterism backed with the meritocratic delusion. And so I think that, you know, like, that's not a plan, but it's a prospectus for a plan. It's like a requirements process for a plan. It tells you what the plan needs to have. But if I had a plan, I'd be out there in the streets, right? Not trying to think this stuff through in fiction.
A plan for a plan. Well, that'll have to do for the moment.
All right.
Thank you, Corey, for coming in. Your book is available now, and I'm assuming there's a non-DRM copy there.
All copies of all of my books are sold without DRM. And I now operate a DRM-free ebook store that just sells my books, but on behalf of my publishers. So wherever you are in the world, you buy it from the US, I remit the publisher's share to my American publisher. You buy it in the UK, I remit to them. And if you buy it in open territory in Europe, I get all the money. It's all DRM-free, and it's not just DRM-free, it's actually license agreement-free. So when you buy it, there's no terms of service. The deal is like, don't violate copyright law. It's the same deal as all the print books you've ever bought. Instead of, you know, I have unilaterally renegotiated 5,000 years of literary norms deciding what you can and can't do with this book because it's now bits. And so that's at craphound.com/shop. And you can get it, all my books and my audiobooks there.
Well, I've read it. It's very good. It also contains a lot of very good text, which is, as is well known fact, extremely hard to write. So,
and without it, there wouldn't be any of us.
Indeed.
Yeah.
Cory Doctorow, thank you very much for coming in.
Cheers. Thanks.
Bye.
Bye.